My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we've got something a little different. We're not looking at a policy paper, but an actual final decision from the Los Angeles Office of Appeals.
Yeah, we're really getting into the weeds on this one. It's a fantastic way to see how the burden of proof for federal disaster aid just crushes people who aren't prepared.
Exactly. So our mission here is to take this one case, case number 10494024, and use its failure points as like a shortcut to understanding administrative law.
It really shows you what it takes to qualify for this kind of specialized aid. The program in question is Disaster Unemployment Assistance, or DUA.
And this was all triggered by a specific event, right?
Right. It was activated after the Los Angeles wildfires, which started around January 7th, 2025. And DUA is very specific. It's for people unemployed as a direct result of the disaster.
And this is the key part. They also have to be ineligible for regular state unemployment compensation.
That's the one. And that is exactly where this whole case just starts to unravel from the very beginning.
Okay, so let's talk about the claimant, Nicholas Donahue. The entire appeal seems to hinge on this massive contradiction in his employment status.
It is. It's the foundation for the whole decision. So to understand it, we really have to walk through the timeline.
Let's do it.
Okay, so he was a regular W-2 employee at USC from August to October of 2024.
Standard job. Clear employment history.
Yeah.
But then that job ended.
It did. So on November 3rd, 2024, he files for regular state unemployment benefits, and he gets them. They run out on February 8th, 2025.
And to get those, every single week he has to certify something.
He has to certify under penalty of perjury that he was not working.
Okay. Meanwhile, in the middle of all that, on January 7th, the wildfires start.
Exactly. So his regular benefits run out in February. Then on March 12th, he files a new claim, this time for DUA.
But his story changes.
Completely. Now he's arguing he was an unemployed, self-employed worker whose business was impacted by the fires.
Wow. So you can't. I mean, the judge must have seen that immediately. He's telling the state, I am 100% unemployed to get one check. Then he tells the federal government, actually, I was working for myself the whole time to get another check. It's an administrative catch-22.
It is. The administrative law judge, the ALJ, literally wrote that the claimant cannot have it both ways. It just destroyed his credibility before they even got to the evidence.
That's interesting. He did fight pretty hard procedurally. He got his appeal reopened twice.
He did, yeah. He missed the first two hearings, but argued he had good cause, you know, a bad connection one time, illness the next, and the judge agreed.
So he got his day in court.
He absolutely did, but winning on procedure doesn't help when the substance of your claim fails on, well, multiple fronts.
Which brings us to the first big hurdle.
Yeah.
Proving he was even self-employed to begin with.
Right. This is where the documentation rules just come down like a hammer. The specific rule, it's in the Code of Federal Regulations, requires you to provide proof of your self-employment within 21 days of applying.
And it has to be recent proof, I assume.
It has to be recent, verifiable proof. And the evidence he gave was, well, the judge called his testimony unreliable and improbable.
Ouch. Why? What was so improbable about it?
Well, for one, he couldn't seem to keep the story straight about what his business even was.
Oh.
First, he told the department he was handling billing for different companies. Then, in his testimony, he said he was doing property management services. And then, he also said he was running a nonprofit human services company.
Wait, a nonprofit and a property management company at the same time? I mean, those are fundamentally different things.
They are. And for all three of these supposed businesses, he had no current records, no bank statements from late 2024, no invoices, no proof of any income at all after his USC job.
So what did he provide?
The only real business records he had were from 2022.
2 years old?
Yeah.
That doesn't really help you prove you had a business running right before a fire in January 2025.
Not at all. And then there's this one piece of evidence that was just particularly bad for him.
Go on.
He produced an invoice dated January 15th, 2025 for talent booking. Okay, so the judge asks for proof of payment.
Makes sense.
He claims it was an exchange of services agreement, you know, a barter deal.
Okay, that's plausible, I guess, for a small business.
It would be, except the invoice itself, the one he provided, directly contradicted him. It listed a clear due date for a monetary payment. It said nothing about bartering.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So his own documents sank his story.
Completely. He couldn't produce any other paperwork to back up the barter claim. And that just solidified the judge's opinion that he wasn't being truthful.
So this is the big lesson, right? If you're going to claim self-employment, the burden of proof is on you. You have to meet that preponderance of the evidence standard.
Which just means more likely to be true than not true. And with inconsistent testimony and old paperwork.
Yeah, he wasn't even close. The judge concluded it was more likely that he was not self-employed right before the fires.
Correct. So the claim failed right there. But that wasn't the only reason.
There's more. So even if he had somehow proven he was self-employed.
Even then, he would have failed the second test, the disaster causation test.
He still had to prove his unemployment was a direct result of the fire itself.
Exactly. And the regulations are really strict on this. It has to be the immediate result of the major disaster itself and not the result of a longer chain of events.
It can't just be that the economy got bad because of the fire.
No, it has to be direct, like your business burned down or you couldn't physically get to your workplace because of the disaster.
So how did location play into this?
It was fatal to his claim. The officially designated disaster areas were Altadena and Pacific Palisades.
And where was his business?
Well, his headquarters was listed in Banning, California, and he used his home in Los Angeles as his office.
Neither of which were in the designated disaster zone.
Not even close. And he couldn't show any evidence, no contracts, no appointments, that he had any scheduled work in Altadena or Pacific Palisades. The judge pointed out that he was never prevented from reaching his place of work, which was his home office.
So because he wasn't physically located in the disaster area and his work wasn't directly impeded, he failed that second test, too.
That's right. The claim failed on two completely separate and independent grounds. He couldn't prove the employment and he couldn't prove the causation.
Which leads us to the, I guess, the inevitable consequence, the overpayment. He got money he wasn't eligible for. What happens then?
The feds want it back. The liability is crystal clear in the regulations. If you get DUA payments you weren't entitled to, you are liable for repayment.
And it doesn't matter if it was your fault or not. Like, even if the state made a mistake and paid you.
It doesn't matter. It's not about fault. If you weren't eligible, you owe the money back. Period.
So what was the final number?
The decision held him liable for the full $4,400 he had been paid over 16 weeks. And of course, his claim for the rest of the 26-week DUA period was also denied.
Wow. This whole deep dive into one case, it's just such a clear picture of how unforgiving these requirements are. It really comes down to two things.
Mm-hmm.
You need absolute, verifiable proof of your income status, and you need clear, direct evidence that the disaster is what caused you to be unemployed.
And if we pull back to the bigger picture here, what this case really screams is that in the world of administrative law, your documentation is your reality.
Your testimony doesn't matter as much.
Especially if it's inconsistent. When you have testimony that contradicts itself and is even contradicted by your own weak paperwork, you have no chance. The claimant just provided weaker evidence when he clearly could have and should have provided something stronger.
And that, combined with the initial lie on the UI claim, just sealed his fate. So I think this leaves us with a really important question for you, the listener. If you ever had to rely on government aid that's tied to a specific date, like a disaster, think about this. How much proof do you have right now to prove what your income status was in the weeks leading up to today?
It's something to really consider. It shows that the burden isn't just on the government to check the boxes. The burden is on you to keep immaculate records. Just in case.
A truly rigorous look at what it takes to navigate disaster aid. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts. Tonight, you just left for work and had a non-specific feeling that something was happening to your place and it wasn't good. Dan?
Exactly, Tammy. It could be smoke damage, theft, or just too much caffeine, but you can't stop thinking about it.
But with renter's insurance through GEICO, your stuff is covered, so you don't have to worry.
And that's great, because the weekend is coming up and it's chock full of social obligations that are ready to fill that void.
Oh boy, will they, Dan? It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.